clean contact.
I'd hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment, or the moment defines you.
Oh my goodness.
Hello and welcome to the Golf Practice Podcast. My name is Andy Hayes and with me is Ty Libby and Jansen Mizurek.
Hey Andy, how you doing?
Fantastic. It's a podcast day, Ty. How could I not be doing just great? It is a Monday. It's a Monday morning. A little tired getting up today. We had lots of Junior Essentials classes yesterday, a few near-death experiences, but everyone, you know, made it out fine. And so you get to be here today with you guys and record a podcast. I don't think it could get much better than this.
And Mondays are always fun with Jansen.
I know.
Monday, stand by to get some.
Jansen, you seem to have a unique perspective on Mondays in general.
Monday is hands down, without a doubt, my favorite day of the week. I think that starting your week off in a positive way is the only way to go. And so every single Monday, I get up at 4:30 and I go work out and I just get my day off started right. I come in, I do the bunkers in the facility, and it's just like the schedule I do. I started it last winter, and then for the summer, I got up almost every morning at 4:30 to get up to Lake Bluff to do the programming, and it's just something that I like to do. I think the reason why I do it is because people like to complain on Mondays of how tired they are, or, you know, they had a long weekend, or, you know, whatever it is. So I say, no, let's break out of that bad habit of complaining and whining, and let's get after it.
I don't know if it's about complaining and whining. I mean, today my wife Jenny woke me up at 6:45 and I drove her to the train, and then I sat around, watched a documentary on Lady Gaga for a couple hours, and then came in here to work and started making this podcast.
Well, see, so you woke up early. That's pretty early. 6:45?
That's not...
You were
woke up at 6:45 and then sat around, and you woke up at 4:30 and just got going.
But you know what? You didn't sleep until 10.
Okay.
That's a win. Well,
all right, thank you. Ty, what's your Monday routine?
My Monday routine is a little bit of recovery from the weekend, but as soon as I get here and see Jansen, he just gets me amped up, and I go hit some putts, you know, get loosened up and get ready for the day.
Okay. Well, now that we got that out of the way.
Glad we got that out of the way.
And maybe next week on the Golf Practice Podcast, what is Tuesday?
Yeah, what is that?
Hopefully you're inspired to have a greater Monday, everyone. One of the first ideas of this podcast came when Phil Mickelson was recorded during a Pro-Am tournament giving Larry Fitzgerald a chipping lesson. And he said, there are only three ways to chip. And knowing Jansen is our chipping short game guru, the next day at work, I showed him this. And I was like, look at these cool things Phil says. And Jansen's like, yeah, that's not quite true. And so I said, we got to get this on the podcast, Jansen versus Phil, who's seen as one of the most amazing short game players in the history of golf, and Jansen Mizurek, the Golf Practice as short game guru. I think it's an even fight.
Have you won multiple major championships, Jansen?
I have a green jacket.
Okay,
it's
okay.
Just a North Face jacket.
Well, so Jansen, are you up for the battle?
I think so.
Okay. Well, so the way we're gonna start this podcast out, we'll just play this audio recording. It was recorded on someone's cell phone, and so there's birds chirping. The voice isn't quite as loud as, you know, if Phil were in the room with us. Maybe in a few years down, once we get a few more subscribers, we could get Phil in the room with us, but we're not quite there yet. So we'll just bear with us as we listen to it, and maybe you will learn something, and then we'll kind of talk about our reactions to it.
Whereas a putter is square face, you have a lot of coverage on the ball. When you're at 60 degrees aloft, you're coming with the leading edge. So we have to keep the leading edge down. Everything we do in chipping is to keep the leading edge down. So when we chip, there are three things you have to do or you cannot chip. The first is to keep the leading edge down, our weight has to be on our front foot. You cannot chip with the weight on your back foot because the leading edge comes up, right? So our weight has to be forward. The second thing we have to do, and this is where everybody messes up, is you have to decide if you're going low or high. And if you go low, the ball is placed off your back foot, given this area, okay? And if you're going high, it's placed off your front foot. It's either off the toe or even further in front. If I'm going low, it's off my back foot or even further back. It's never in between your feet. Never. Because if it's in between your feet, you now can't put your weight forward or you'll go over the top of it, right? You can't hit it high doing that. You can't hit it low with the ball in the middle of your chest. You're not de-lofting it enough. So what happens is your weight then gets leveled out and you try to scoop it. You can't do that. The third thing is you have to keep, when you chip, your arm and club need to have an inverse line. Most people have this type of V. It needs to be that type of V. And once it's locked in, it's easy to get, so the leading edge stays down.
The only three ways to chip. My favorite thing about Phil Mickelson in general is how certain he is of everything.
Oh, absolutely.
There's only three ways to chip. We got a couple more videos coming later where he even takes it up to another level when he starts talking about the morning dew and
percentage plays.
Yeah. So, Jansen, can you maybe just like recap Phil's only three ways to chip and then give us a little analysis of it.
My take. All right. Yeah. So the first thing he said was to be able to chip, you have to have your weight forward or on the target side of your body. And I actually agree with that. It is important to have weight on the target side of your body so that you can more predictably control your arc or the low point of your swing. And it prevents, especially in beginner golfers, we that's one of the fundamentals that we really, really like to teach or make sure that they are doing in their setup position, because it prevents them from leaning backwards or reverse pivoting or scooping the ball and falling backwards away from the target, which is going to lead to all sorts of problems. And so that is a big fundamental that I agree with. But if you're more at an elite level, you want your weight a little bit more 50-50 or 60-40, not quite as severe as he was showing in the video there or describing, so that you can have softer hands and get more crafty with the loft that you are using. But from a very fundamental standpoint, I think that having weight on the target side of your stance is a good thing.
So when you say softer hands, what exactly are you talking about? Active hands through the swing, or do you like quiet hand? Or what are you referring to?
Yeah, so soft hands. I don't know if I've ever thought about how to explain that. I think when you know when you have them, and you know when you don't have them. I think like Coach Mike and I kind of would agree with saying soft hands is when we're purposely let the club head outrace our hands so that we're sliding the club face underneath the golf ball, typically to hit high shots. But soft hands just means that you have touch and feel to be able to really finesse the wedge around the greens and hit really, really delicate chip shots where you have to be extremely accurate with your strike and the crisp contact in a sense. So having soft hands, in my opinion, is allowing the club head to release and swing rather than yanking on the grip and not having a fluid chipping motion. I think that's probably the best way to think about it.
So you're saying having your weight forward when chipping is good for beginners, but once you get really good at that, you should work on other things because it's too limiting?
I think you just have a better awareness when you're getting to a more advanced, or you need a more a larger arsenal of shots around the green. I think it's easier to manipulate your weight in certain ways once you know what you're dealing with coming into the shot. But from a very beginner standpoint, I think always just having a little bit of extra weight on the target side of your stance is good.
How good do you think you'd have to be to start doing what you're saying?
I don't know. I don't think there's a specific number, like your handicap, that you have to do.
I mean, like, let's say someone's struggling to break 90.
Then I'd keep your weight. I'd focus more on just the very fundamentals.
Okay.
Yeah.
85?
85, you can probably start to get a little crafty.
Okay.
Yeah. Because to break 85, you have to start to have a wider array of shots around the greens. Your short game has to get to the next level.
You mean you have to be able to hit high shots, low shots?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Cool.
The next one was ball up in the front of your stance or in the back. And so I loved how he described the first decision you have to make before you put the ball up in your stance or back is decide what type of shot you want to hit. And is that a high shot or a low shot? And that's so important when it comes to the setup because you have to set yourself up for success. And I like to say if you want to hit it up in the air, you have to move it up. He's exactly right. Again, that allows time for the club head to release more, which means that the more loft will be exposed. It's a little bit of a crisper gliding kind of motion you can think about. And if you want to go low, you almost want to trap the ball, or as he put it, have more coverage over the ball. And so then you want to kind of catch it more on the downswing and moving that in the back of the stance at the descending blow portion of the arc is the place to go. So I think the way he describes it is in perfect Phil fashion. A little over-exaggerated where he says it's never in between your feet. I don't agree with that at all. But I do agree for the fact that you never really play it too much in the middle. You always either want it slightly back or up. And so when he says, I would use your big toes as reference for me. Like when I play it, like my stock medium trajectory shot, what I say is in the middle is kind of in line with like just on the inside of my right big toe or like my right ball of the foot.
So when you're chipping, how much of when you're deciding a trajectory is like the club you're going to use, like your pitching wedge or maybe your 9-iron versus where you're positioning the ball in your stance?
That's a great question. I think first you have to choose the club based on how much green you have to work with and the lie. And then to complement that, then adjust the stance or the setup in the ball position. That's how I'd go about it. So if I have a shot that I need to carry a bunker and I don't have a lot of green to work with, obviously I'm going to pull a lob wedge. And then I'm most likely going to move it up in my stance as well. But if I have a good lie, I might play it a little bit more back. It just depends. Maybe there's a slope that I can utilize. Mm-hmm. So then I could allow the ball to release more. So yeah, again, I think Phil describes it in an extreme way, which is good, and it makes it obvious to how you should think. It's like a very structured thought process of how to approach a short game shot, which is great. But I don't necessarily agree with having it a foot behind your right foot if you're a right-handed player for hitting a low one, because you're just going to dig the leading edge straight into the ground, and it's going to be choppy and nasty and not feel very good.
I mean, he uses a 64 degree wedge, so I suppose if you have one of those you can try that, but
yeah,
or else you can just hit a normal shot.
Yeah, he was talking about using a 60 degree wedge in that video, and so I guess if you want to hit a 60 degree low, you do have to move it that far back. But then open up your eyes and use a different club. It's not, and then you can take a smaller swing and have more control.
All right, and the third thing that you have to do when you chip is...
you have to have your hands in front. And I think he was saying that you have to do that at address so that through the swing, your hands are also in front too. I personally, and when I like to teach chipping, I like a very, very neutral shaft position, which means a very up and down. If you were to look face on to the golfer, the shaft would not be at an angle leaning towards the target. It would be in a more up and down fashion. But it is important that you do have a slight, just a little bit of forward shaft lean, like he says, to keep the leading edge down. But I like the neutral shaft position so that the bounce can glide a little bit more smoothly through the shot. One thing that he did not mention was rotation of the body. He was all about talking about what your hand should do and where the ball position should be. I think that the more you rotate, the more you can experiment with ball position, because that rotation is going to allow the bounce of the club, which is if you don't know what the bounce is the sole of the club or that rounded bottom portion underneath the leading edge, and allows that to glide through the ground and not get stuck. And that just opens up a whole new arsenal of shots around the green. The more you rotate with your body or open it up to the target, then you can experiment with more with more ball positions and in different trajectories, automatically rotating is going to get your hands in front of the golf ball regardless. It's going to get the hands in front of or have the handle lead through the ball without like yanking on it with your hands or just swinging with your arms.
Is that a mistake you see a lot of people making?
Oh,
not rotating?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think people around the greens are hitting wedge shots in general think that they have to be, they know that it's a short swing, but they don't have the touch or the experience or the reps to have that feel and that touch. And so they're trying to be as robotic as possible. And so what they get in the habit of is just trying to hit it with their hands. And that's the last thing you want to hit these shots with. You want to hit it with your body and you want to feel the club head swing as much as possible. And so definitely, I think people, as Stan Elliott would say, they become grip tuggers or yanking on the grip, right? And so the grip is moving all over the place instead of staying somewhat neutral and allowing the club head to move up and down and through the ball nicely.
So if you were playing in a pro-am with Larry Fitzgerald and he was hitting some bad chips and you were like, Larry, get over here. There's three things you can do to chip. What would your three be?
My first one would be that we want a narrow stance so that we can rotate more. And then with that narrow stance, we can be a little bit more accurate of where we're placing the ball relative to our feet. We can measure a little bit better because there's not as much variability. So the first thing would be a narrow stance to allow rotation. The second thing would be probably the same thing Phil said would be, do you want to go high or low? And then that will base your ball position. And the third thing being, let the club head swing. Okay. Can you feel the club head swing?
I'm just trying to, how do you describe that? Like, let the club.
Yeah.
Swinging a club, doesn't the club head swing automatically?
That's a good question, but it doesn't. Because you can swing the club. But if you look at it on video, if you see it, people are carrying the club.
So once again, I think this gets back to active wrists, active hands idea. So don't be afraid to use your hands.
Use your wrist, man. Yeah. Use your wrist. Absolutely. Be wristy, not handsy.
Right.
Yeah. That's one I like to say.
So I'm just like swinging here in my chair. If I don't move my wrist at all and try to do a swing while not moving my wrists, that you would call that carrying the club?
I would call that carrying the club.
Whereas if I start with wrists, that's more of the swing that you're talking about.
Correct.
Okay.
You're lifting, you're hinging, you're lifting the club head up so that then gravity can take it back down.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Well, I think yours is better than
well, I don't
this
know.
This podcast is gonna go viral and
he brings some great points up, and I agree with like the first half of the video, and then he starts getting crazy with the handle of the club, and I was just like, what are you talking about, Phil? So he, classic Phil, he goes to the extreme of it, which I think is good and okay for beginners, but you have to go a step further and really, really look at it and say, okay, are you really going to use a 60 degree around for every shot around the green? And what other things are you doing as you're demonstrating this that you're not talking about? One of those being rotation, mm-hmm. which I think is extremely important.
Yeah. Okay. Well, my love of Phil came when last year when he was on the David Faraday's show, and he shows up for his interview wearing a leather jacket mm-hmm. and just gives some of the greatest stories and analysis that I've ever heard. So
it was a great episode.
Yeah, we're going to play a few highlights for the people. The first is talking about his shot out of the pine straw at the Masters the last time he won. If you've ever watched the Masters, you've seen the shot a million times because they replay it over and over and over. He's up on the hill on the right. It's hole
13.
Hole 13, that's 13, yeah.
13, the last hole at Amen Corner.
Oh, he's up on the right on hole 13. He's in between two trees off the pine straw, and he hits it, and it just carries the creek and gets pretty close to the hole. And so here he is talking about that shot. Our podcast intro starts off with, I think, Gary McCord saying clean contact, and that is from the Phil shot. So
clean contact.
One of the greatest shots that I ever saw on the 13th from the pine straw in between the trees.
It was the percentage play.
The percentage?
The percentage play. Now,
let me explain how
it's the percentage play. Internally, you have a shot dispersion, so very few people hit every shot right at the pin. for me, a left-handed player, if I pull it, it's going to go longer right, and if I push it, it's going to go shorter left. Well, the green sits like this. So if I aim at the center of the green and I come out of it, it goes short left, it's still on the green. And if I pull it, and I normally don't ever admit this, but I might have pulled that one fractionally, it goes longer right and ends up carrying the creek in this situation.
Right.
Also, when you're in pine needles, the more loft you have, the more opportunity for stuff to get between the ball and the face, shoot sideways, and potentially hit the tree. So the straighter-faced club I can hit gets more coverage on the ball and reduces the ability of stuff to get in between the ball and the face. So I had to go between that gap. I couldn't go left of the trees or right of the trees. I had to go between them. So hitting a wedge was a greater risk than hitting a six iron. And the green sets up so perfectly that I had a huge shot dispersion.
Margin of error.
And so that was the high percentage play.
So when I first saw Phil hit that shot, I never considered that it was a high percentage play. I thought he was doing a risky shot, and he barely pulled it off, maybe got a little bit lucky. But here, the way you hear Phil tell it, that's what he had, you know, as a smart play to make.
It's like the no-brainer.
No-brainer.
It's really cool to hear him describe that.
It's a par five. Most people probably would have laid up, but he says, no, that was the smartest play. And I'm not entirely sure I agree with him, but that's why I'm sitting here. Making a podcast. And he's on tour.
I remember watching the shot live and being flabbergasted that he was even going to attempt it. And so when he pulled it off, you know, the roars from the gallery were, needless to say, impressive. I'd never considered what he was saying about being more risky to hit a wedge because the stuff could get in front of the face. You know, it seems like most people there maybe use a flat face club and just punch it out into the fairway and then attack the green. I think that's probably what most players do, but certainly an impressive shot. Never one that I can hope to make, so it's hard for me to relate to it. But yeah.
I think I agree. I think most people, if they were leading the tournament or had a huge lead, would take a less lofted club to, as he says, have more coverage over the ball, which I really like the way he describes that. And he said that in the other video too, coverage of the ball, just making sure that like the centerness of contact is basically guaranteed. But I think they would just do that and then punch it up, run it up and try and get up and down. But he had a six iron in. So I think that was a little bit of a risk that he said, well, hey, I'm not hitting a four or five here, but I got a mid iron. So I'm going to do it, which is pretty cool. But it's that's a short par five out there for those guys typically.
So. And at the beginning of the video, he talked about how it was a percentage play based on how the green was shaped. That if he pulled it, it would go farther, or if he pushed it, it would go shorter. Can you describe what he was talking about there?
Absolutely. So if you have ever hit on TrackMan, or even just pay a little more attention to your landing zones. When you're out on the golf course, whenever you pull a shot, it's going to go further because your face and your path are matching. And so
pulling a shot for a righty versus a lefty is?
Would be that it's going...
pulling a shot for a right-handed golfer would be left of target line.
Correct.
Pushing it would be right of target line. And he's flipped because he's left-handed, obviously.
Right. So for Phil, a pull would pull it to the right. But we'll assume that everybody here is right-handed players just because majority are. But so a pull, right, my face and path are basically traveling in the same direction. So the club is a little bit more de-lofted, and everything's kind of matching up, and the centerness of contact is typically pretty good when you pull it. And so it's just going to sail. It's going to go an extra few yards or kind of like an extra club almost. And when you push one, that means that the face is a little more open than you were probably hoping. And so that means that there's a little bit more added loft. And so the ball is going to typically go higher, which means it's going to land shorter. And so if you ever hit on a TrackMan, you'll see that the ones you hit straight or fan out a little bit to the right probably are going to have a higher carry distance, maybe, but they're not going to roll out as much. And it'll be kind of, just a few yards shy of what you've you probably could suspect from that club. But when you pull one, you're kind of like, holy smokes, that thing just jumped on me and sails, and it'll go forever.
Great. All right. Well, we got one more video here. Most people, when they have a pitching wedge in the fairway, they say, well, I just got, or when they have 140 yards out, they say, I'll just grab my 9-iron and I'll hit it towards the green. But when Phil Mickelson sees that ball, he sees a lot more things.
You've always thought that way, very analytical.
There's a lot that I process on every shot, and there's a lot of detail. Do you want me to touch on it, or do you really, is it boring?
Hey, tell me about it.
Well, in my practice, I build a reference. So I hit the same shot over and over, building a 9-iron that goes 145 yards, let's say. Now, that will vary based on temperature and altitude, and which will change with time of day and whatnot, as well as wind and those effects. But one of the things people will say is I hit my wedge, you know, 120. Well, you might hit a 120 under certain conditions, but in the morning, ball's not going to go 120. Maybe in the afternoon when it's warmer and the ball heats up, but it's going to go 5 to 10 yards shorter in the morning. People don't factor that in. If you get a little bit of water in between the club face and the ball, people don't know. It actually increases spin, causes it to go shorter. The first cut always comes out 6 to 8 yards dead. If the grain is into you, it's going to launch and hit lower on the face, launch lower, have more spin. If it's down grain, the club slides a little bit quicker. You'll get more out of it. If it's sitting up on zoysia or off of a tee, always goes 5 yards farther with each iron, based on the fact that the center of gravity is underneath the ball and it launches higher, a little bit less spin. All these things I have to factor in when I look at the lie. Okay, how is the lie and how is the ball going to come out relative to my 145 9-iron? Now, that's 10 off a stock, so I have a normal swing.
Right.
And then I have a second swing for every iron shot. And that's it's a little bit shorter backswing with the same acceleration. So I have a 145 and a 155-yard shot. What is the lie going to do? What's the temperature? What's the wind? How do I want the ball coming into the green? If you choke down an inch, 3 yards comes off of it. One degree aloft is 3 yards. So if you open the face a degree, that's 3 yards. So if I have a reference of 145, I want it to fly 142, I can choke down an inch. It'll come in a little bit lower, a little bit flatter, and release. Or I can just open it up and hit a little bit of a cut. That'll be 3 yards, but it'll back up. All these variables, like, I'll process like that when I look at the lie and assess the situation, see what kind of grass it is. And those are the nuances that allow me to be so precise with my wedges and my short irons and my distance control.
Right.
And that's why iron play has been such a strength for my game, is that I'm able to be precise to within a yard or two. And in my practice sessions, because I hit 1,500 balls every month to those specific numbers, my reference is pretty on. If I hit a shot 145 and I feel like I nailed it, it usually does that. Yeah.
All right, so what are we supposed to make of that?
It's a lot to take in.
Are you calculating that many variables when you're hitting your shots?
No. I want to say yes, but no. I think, again, kind of going back to what I said earlier with when we were talking about chipping, the more advanced you're playing, or the more elite tournaments or whatever you're playing, the better you are, the more factors that you do need to take into account. So that you can play at that level. But it's funny. I think as golfers, it's funny to list all those things out, just like Phil did. It took him, what, two and a half minutes to do that. But all of those decisions are being made extremely quickly in your head as you're walking up to the ball or as you are taking your practice swings. They're just happening. They're just thoughts. But that comes through practice and repetition of practicing that routine. What's the order of things that you look into? When do you take your first breath? When do you take the step into the ball? How many practice swings are you going to take? When are you thinking about club selection? You know, all of those factors. But they're happening very quickly. But when you talk about it, it's a lot to talk about, because it's a lot of details, as you just heard.
Yeah, it's so many details. I don't know.
It's almost too many. You're kind of like, oh my, just hit the shot, like, or just don't think about it, right? But then if you were to hit a poor shot, you're gonna say, well, I didn't take that into account. And you know,
I guess, but I don't know. I'm so wondering, like, at what point does all this analysis just get in the way of hitting a good shot?
Right. Because you see these guys like go into so much detail sometimes, and then they just make a poor swing and all that prep work. It's like, what was the point of that? You waited all that time for that.
Yeah, it's like,
but when they do, that's why they're able to pull off incredible golf shots like that.
Yeah, but I wonder if could just keeping it simpler result in more good shots.
Bryson DeChambeau would say no.
Yeah.
Well, sure. Yeah. So Bryce, I would imagine. I mean, all stories from the Ryder Cup, Bryson and Phil got along pretty well. They probably look at the game in a very similar way.
Yeah.
But I'd be very surprised if Dustin Johnson's analysis was anything other than, well, I'll hit my pitching wedge. And like, I would just imagine.
Going to hit it.
Exactly. I would imagine if DJ was on Faraday, they'd be like, what'd you do? You know, when you won the U.S. Open, what were you thinking on that last shot? He's like, well, I just had a pitching wedge, so I hit a pitching wedge and it went close to the hole, and I hit two putts. And I mean, like, I would imagine that's the level of detail that he's going in, and he's very successful doing that.
Right. I remember when Bryson DeChambeau first came on tour, and he played a practice round, and I don't know what tournament this was and where I heard it, but he played a practice round with DJ, and DJ looked at him, and there was a quote of him saying, dude, I don't know how you do that. If I did it, I wouldn't be playing this game. Like, you think way too much. You gotta let loose a little bit.
Yeah.
There's a video out there on the internet of a young Dustin Johnson giving a little bit of a quick tutorial. And he says, you know, the most important thing to keep in mind when you're hitting a cut shot is to make sure you cut it.
Yeah.
Like, thanks, DJ.
Thanks, man. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's just... Maybe each person just has to find their own way of, like, what's the right level of analysis versus feel. Right. If you try to, I mean, I imagine most amateur players who are trying to get better, they do almost too much analysis. They make things too complicated when they're actually playing. Right. They're thinking back to the last lesson they had or the last YouTube video they watched or the Golf Digest article they read, and they have all these thoughts in their head, whereas if they would just hit a pitching wedge, they would be fine.
Right. I think you need to know what the conditions are going to be like before you even get to the first tee and have that game plan in place before you even step on the first tee. So if you know that it's going to be windy that day, or you know it's going to be really hot, or you know it's going to be really cold, know how that affects the golf ball and how it might affect your swing. So obviously if it's super hot out and you're playing in the afternoon or early evening, you know that the ball can go far. It can go really far. If you're at altitude, definitely... spend some time on the range or do that calculation of what your yardages are going to be, because the air is thinner, the ball is going to fly further. But these are things that you can do before the round and know that game plan, so that you're not behind every shot pulling out your calculator trying to figure out the altitude or the wind or things like that. Again, in the morning, like he said, the ball's not going to go as far in the morning. It's colder, and there's typically a little bit more moisture in the air, and so that's going to affect... how far the ball goes as well. Now, is it going to be 5 yards every time shorter or 5 yards long every single time? No, but there is a range, and you can predict that, like he was saying, and have your shot dispersion. And the more you know things like that in a broad aspect, the more prepared you can be. But you want to be able to prepare, I think, before the round more so, just so you're not wasting time out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was following a lot of what he was saying and kind of relating to it as far as when it's cold it goes shorter, when it's hot it goes farther, choking down if you want to make it go a little bit less, having like a swing that takes 10 yards off. All these things are things that I try to do. And then he said, if you want to make it go 3 yards shorter, you open the club face 1 degree. What do you think about that?
It's extremely precise. It's extremely precise. I think if you're just dealing with 3 yards, I don't know how to answer that, to be honest.
I mean, how can you actually open the club face 1 degree and only 1 degree and know that it's not 2 degrees?
Right.
A degree is not a very big thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just seems like that's too much.
If you hit 1,500 balls like he does, then I guess you know.
And that's only, what, like 50 balls a day? So it's not that many on average, like a 30-day month. But yeah, one thing you were talking about calculators, let's talk about friction coefficients. One thing that stood out to me is he said moisture on the club face will make the ball spin more and go shorter. And that's not my understanding of physics.
It's not my understanding of it either, especially after the last teaching summit that I went to. They had the ping engineers there. I forget what his name was, but he was talking about friction. That was the topic of his presentation, which was pretty awesome. He was talking about, you know, the question we get asked as instructors all the time, especially when it comes to wedge play and short game, they'll look at you with big eyes and say, how do I spin it? And so we have to describe that to him. And the number one, the first thing I tell them is it's friction, which means your strike has to be really, really solid. So let's work on the fundamentals and get a solid strike and a repeatable strike so that you're not chunking it or hitting it thin. And then we can talk about the other things that allow that. But the basis of friction and spin are the drier the conditions, the more spin it's going to have, because the more the ball can grip to the face. Think about sandpaper. If you were to run your hand against sandpaper, your hand's just going to grab it and grip onto it, basically, and it's not going to feel that great. There's a lot of friction there because sandpaper is so dry and rigid. And so that's kind of how I think about the grooves of the golf club. So when there's moisture, and even when you think it's dry out and the grass is dry, there's a lot of moisture in the grass. Grass holds moisture. That's how it survives. That completely changes the conditions of how to hit certain shots. And so when there's morning dew in the morning, the ball is not going to spin as much. It's going to skid. It's going to skid across the water, kind of like a water skier, I guess you could think about. And you're not going to get to spin it as much. It's going to be more of a knuckleball. So there's science backing that. I don't know if Phil has seen it. Maybe you should look into it a little bit.
Put in a call to Bryson.
Yeah, I think so.
Because all these tests say that actually adding water to it makes it spin more.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not what I've heard. It's not what.
Well, I'm just looking at like.
Maybe we should we'll do take some a little tests.
Pause. Maybe yeah. We should do some tests. Why not? We actually, Mike and I actually talked about doing that.
Yeah.
Getting a spray bottle and just putting it by the track, man. I mean, I think of it as just like being super, super simple in the fact of like, if it's dry, you're going to be able to grip something more, which means it's going to spin more because of the grooves. And if it's wet, it's going to be slippery and the traction's not going to be.
Yeah, the first.
It's not going to be good.
The first thing that comes up.
This is from Tour Spec Golf, says that a mist of water on the ball and driver head caused the carry to drop by 8 yards, but the backspin jumped by an average of 700 RPM.
Now, there is the seminar.
Go ahead. Yeah, it says an increase in backspin on the wet results this time by nearly 1,000 RPM, which ends up affecting both carry and overall distance.
The seminar we went to, obviously, the guy talking about it was like a biomechanics guy. The guy was brilliant. And so part of his presentation was pretty hard to follow. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the spin rates. And I want to say that sometimes, yes, they do look higher. But it's just how does the ball react when it finally lands? And so, like he's saying, right, the spin rate was higher, but that didn't mean that it spun back more, which because of the launch angle, I assume.
Okay. So actually, that test was for drivers.
That was for
doing
drivers, right?
If you have your wedge and it's wet, it will spin a lot less, 3,500 RPMs less, which is a lot less.
Yeah.
But if it's your driver, it will actually spin more if it's wet. So
I'm going to have to go back in my notes and see what
blog from Tour Spec Golf's. He says, driver, maybe it's because it's, you know, a flat face.
Right.
The driver's not, it's not designed to spin a ton. And right. So a little bit of water on the face or a club will make it spin more. If it's a wedge or probably a short iron. That's designed to spin. The water will make it spin less.
Makes sense.
So we'll have to send this to Phil. So,
mind-blowing.
Yeah, I know. We're really research. Learning a lot. This
Love
is live that. Learning on the Golf Practice Podcast.
We're deep in we're the deep. Interwebs right
yep.
now.
Yeah. So I guess Bryson DeChambeau does this a lot, as you were saying. He is famous for having a spray bottle out on the driving range and brand new boxes of Titleist Pro V1s that he is taking a new ball out and hitting one without water and then one with water and noticing what the difference was. Again, helpful for some people, probably not helpful for that many people.
And I think Bryson plays Bridgestones.
Oh, Bridgestones. Okay. Sorry. Sorry. Brand new box of Bridgestone. Yeah, I just think it's so interesting hearing these different stories of the guys. Some very technical, high analysis. Others low, you know, low technical, low analysis. I wonder, I mean, we did a podcast about Tiger Woods a while ago, and he changed his swing so many times. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, I always wonder, like, if he was less analytical and just, like, his swing was good enough. Like, he won four majors in a row, and the next year changed his swing. Yeah. Like, what's, why would you do that? I don't know.
Because he wanted more.
I guess, you can't, you know? There's not a fifth major. There's only four. Right. Like, you did it. Yeah. And
well, if you, what's the, what are those small little segments called where they, it's Voices of Champion or Talks with the Champion or whatever. I think, and most of them are about the British Open, and they're like a quick 20 to 30 minute video with the golfers.
Oh yeah, it's a Netflix series. It's called Chronicles of a Champion. Golfer.
That's what it is. Those are fantastic. The one on Tiger, you should listen to him talk about how he, what he takes into account for a shot, and he does it. He talks very in depth about it, just like Phil does, you know, briefly, but he's talking about the first bounce and how the trajectory is going of the ball coming down and the landing angle of the ball and how that's going to affect it to use slopes and how he prepares in his practice rounds for these different trajectory shots and things and how to take in the wind into account. And so just hearing him describe it, it sounds like to me he goes almost a little bit more of a visual approach than Phil does. And the fact that he's looking at what's in front of him and then visualizing different ball flights and then picking a swing to hit the ball flight to fit the slopes or to fit the hole. And so I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's great.
But it's definitely very in-depth too, right?
Yeah, it is. It is. So next week is the match between Tiger and Phil. It's cost $20 to watch it on pay-per-view. Are you going to watch it?
Oh, you better believe
it. You pay it. Ty?
$20? That's pretty good.
I'm not paying $20, but I might go over to Jansen's to watch it.
Come on, we'll all split in. We'll split it by pizza.
Apparently, they're all going to be mic'd up. They're going to have side bets. Phil Mickelson was at, it was like a Lakers game, and they were talking to him on TNT, and he's talking about how Tiger can be over a putt, and Phil will be like, I'll bet you 50 that you miss it. And the guys are like, oh, you'll bet him 50? He's like, 50 G's. So there's going to be apparently lots of betting, but do you think Phil has a chance?
I really don't know. Phil was playing really well at the end of the season and making a comeback, and then he played like garbage in the Ryder Cup.
Yeah, I think so. His Ryder Cup performance was pretty bad. How do you not?
It was kind of the same with Tiger. He played extremely well. Well, he played pretty well consistently throughout the season, and then really well at the end. And then I think he just left it all at East Lake.
Yeah.
Because he just looked exhausted at the Ryder Cup. So I think both of them have definitely taken a little hiatus and have some rest. And so who knows what they're going to come out with? There's going to be a lot of birdies. We know that.
Yeah. So. I'm interested. I just have no idea really what to expect. There hasn't been something like this in a really long time.
Right.
And
looks like Tiger's a pretty big favorite, minus 200. Phil's plus 170. Hmm. So it'll be interesting. Bunch of interesting prop bets, too.
Do you have a couple?
Color of Phil Mickelson's shirt. White, black, blue, any other color.
Is there a bet if it's going to be a button down or not?
It's got to be a white.
Shout out, Mason and Maine.
Yeah, that's right. Is Tiger going to wear his red?
Well, it's not on Sunday. I don't know.
But you never know.
If he wears
it's a big
it,
match.
It is a big match, but I don't know.
There should be a bet to see how many times Tiger changes his shirt because he sweats through it.
Oh, I actually think Tiger is going to come out in that muscle shirt, backwards hat, and sunglasses like he did.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know where that one
I love that. There's so many good memes of that.
Yep. Okay. Well, I think this podcast has gone on long enough. We've really, any sense of rails that we had are long gone. But if you're still with us, thank you for listening. Ty, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Andy.
Jansen, as always, it's been great.
My pleasure. I enjoyed duking it out with Phil. And hey, my way is definitely not the right way. I'm not saying that my stuff is right or I'm better or whatever. And I respect Phil. I respect all short game instructors. But this is the way I look at it. There's a few things that you should just look a little deeper into. Sometimes.
Jantz is still working on raising the $10 million to take on Phil.
But thank you for having me.
Yep.
I really don't know what we'll use this stuff for.
Well, let's just roll right into it.
Let's do it.
Okay, so. Oh, yeah.
Do you have a couple?
Color of Phil Mickelson's shirt. White, black, blue, any other color.
Is there a bet if it's going to be a button down or not?
Oh. It's got to be a white.
Shout out, man.
Yeah, that's right. Is Tiger going to wear his red?
Well, it's not on Sunday. I don't know.
But you never know.
If he wears it.
It's a big match.
It is a big match, but I don't know.
There should be a bet to see how many times Tiger changes his shirt because he sweats through it.
Oh, I actually think Tiger is going to come out in that muscle shirt, backwards hat, and sunglasses like he did.
Oh, yeah.
On the way to that one.
I love that. There's so many good memes of that.
Yep. Okay. Well, I think this podcast has gone on long enough. We've really, any sense of rails that we had are long gone. But if you're still with us, thank you for listening. Ty, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Andy.
Jansen, as always, it's been great.
My pleasure. I enjoyed duking it out with Phil. And hey, my way is definitely not the right way. I'm not saying that my stuff is right or I'm better or whatever. And I respect Phil. I respect all short game instructors. But this is the way I look at it. There's a few things that you should just look a little deeper into.
Jantz is still working on raising the $10 million to take on Phil.
Right. But thank you for having me.
Yep.